G'day, folks. Talk to Mark Charette, a Google Trusted Photographer and the world of 360 photography. And from his part, everything technical about it, which was fascinating. And also jumped into virtual reality and augmented reality and just the future of where this can go. Awesome. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Mark. Brother. Mark Charette. Thanks for coming down, mate. Really appreciate you taking the time to come down and have a yarn about the world of 360 photography.
Very happy to have you invite me. Thank you for inviting.
Mate, and I just want to go into when you're talking about 360 photography. So if we can explain to the viewers and the listeners what 360 photography is in its essence.
Right. The core of 360 photography, and I'm going to use the occasional big word, and we're going to demystify those big words too so that they don't stay big words to people. But 360 photography requires a form of photography called equirectangular photography. Now, the easy way to understand what equirectangular photography is, you know, if you've ever seen in books, you know, in for geography books, the world map, and it's all stretched out.
Yep,
probably
yep.
Seen when it's, okay. That's actually an equirectangular view of the world. That's what it is. You're taking a sphere and you're stretching it out and making it into a rectangle that is twice as wide as it is high. So in other words, it's a 2:1 ratio. And that's what an equirectangular is, two rectangles.
Yes.
Or two squares, basically, that are basically make it so that it's a 2:1 ratio. So when the 360 photography is shot, what you're essentially doing is you're recreating that same world map kind of view as a photo. That's how it's actually created. So it's a pretty fascinating thing, and it's something that's been around for quite a long time. In fact, actually, the very first spherical and cylindrical images were shot a long, long time ago.
Because that's what I was going to say a lot. As soon as you said sphere, that's from what I've seen with some of the 360 photography online or just pictures in general, where it does look like a sphere, like it looks like it's a bend around an image, like it's been stretched and pulled.
Correct.
As such.
Correct. That's exactly it. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that when you're actually looking at a 360 photo on a flat surface, on a computer screen or a mobile phone, whatever you're looking at it on, it's, you know, there's going to have to be some form of stretching if you're going to have a wide field of view. It's no different than a wide angle lens on a camera. Whenever you look at a really, really wide angle lens, you'll always see that whatever's, you know, on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side, it looks a little bit big. And we always tell people if you're going to be in a photograph and it's a wide-angle lens, stand in the middle so you don't look all kind of funny, right? It's the same thing, right? But with the 360s, as you pan around, you're actually changing that field of view so that whatever's in the center then starts to look all normal again.
Yep.
All right? So that's the beauty behind that. And the way that I shoot 360 photography primarily is through the use of a DSLR camera and a fisheye lens. I use primarily it's a fisheye lens on a crop camera body sensor, which means what it does is it actually allows me to have a 180 degree field of view all the way up and down and about 120 degrees across from left to right, and I take four photos all the way around and then I stitch them together to make that one sphere.
I've always wondered how you'd go about stitching them together. But see with, going back into where it started with 360 photography in general, this is not just for yourself but where it originated from. So was it a bit of an accident, or was it someone looking at, you know, an actual lens and thinking like how they can take advantage of, like if we shoot this way or manipulate the lens and the camera this way or... Mm.
It's a good question. I don't really know that much about the real origin and that far back. There's other people who are friends of mine who are far more into the history than I am. And, you know, and I'm more than happy to, I'll share some names, you know, afterwards if you'd like, so that people can hook up with these people and ask them questions. I'm sure they'd be happy to answer the questions. Yep. But the space of how it actually came to be into the 360 world that we know it as today is... Really, primarily, it was done by using what I use right now, which is a standard digital camera, and then being able to stitch the images together. But before that, what they were doing, and in fact, there's a fellow down in Adelaide who I know who's been doing photography for a very, very, very long time. He was doing 360s with film. So you can imagine what that would have been like. Yeah. Oh,
trying to cut and paste.
Literally, yeah. So you could imagine how much time it would have taken to make sure that each one of those negatives were actually, you know, shot and stitched together. And you know, the way he was projecting it, yeah, would have been incredibly complex to do.
Yeah, trying to get it spot on, like just knowing that image, is that the right one to stitch up with that one?
Exactly.
And then it'd be trial and error. If you threw that up on sequence, mm-hmm, and then you're like, where it would, you know, maybe skip a sequence, you'd be like, oh, I stitched it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of work, you know, and of course, nowadays it's far easier. It's still very complex. I mean, there's no doubt that this is still considered to be a very technical form of photography, but it's come a long way. It's at the point now where I can shoot 360 photos at a rate of several. Like I just did recently, I did the virtual tour for Nora Head Lighthouse here on the Central Coast.
Oh, nice.
Yes, and it was actually a pretty large shoot, and I actually even brought a mate of mine along to help help me out through the process, and he was also videoing me doing the work so that we can actually have a bit of a story to tell behind it, and we'll be able to share that as soon as that comes out. He's still in production for that right now. But that particular shoot, we arrived on site at roughly about 6:30 in the morning, and we left the site at 9:45, and that was that.
Hold
that
on, 6:30 in the morning.
Yeah, till 9:45 in the morning. Oh. So not the evening. 9:45.
Okay. Yep.
So we wanted to get some sunrise shots, and I in that time was able to shoot about 80 to 90. Spherical images of inside the tower, the whole length of the walkway, outside on the grounds, so that people can get a really positive experience of what it's like to actually walk through the whole area.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. And so did the weather turn out for you too
with
the sunrise?
It did, yeah. So we would have probably liked the clouds to be in slightly different places than they were. But there's also the advantage of if there's too much cloud cover and clouds as they shift or move, especially when the sun's in that very low position, can make it very, very difficult for the lighting conditions to stay consistent as I shoot all three or four images all the way around. Because you can imagine if the sun's out and I'm pointing in the direction of the sun, then sun goes behind a cloud and I turn and I take the next shot, then the lighting conditions would have changed completely, right?
Yeah.
So the ideal situation is to shoot quickly enough so that the lighting stays the same throughout the whole of the image.
And can you... So when you're talking about the sun and how it affects, mm-hmm, like your image, do you use any filters at all?
No, I don't actually. The thing that I use the most to be able to get good blending of the imagery is to use a way of photography called bracketing or HDR photography. And the whole idea behind bracketing is to take anywhere between, as opposed to just taking one image, you take the same a photo at in exactly the same field of view and simply leave your shutter either open longer or shorter and in multiple images. So between 3 to 7 images are taken in any one direction. And those images then get blended together. And what that does is it gives you a lot better low light and high light kind of conditions. You can actually see into the shadows a lot more. And it doesn't make all the, where it was too bright, it brings it back down to normal. So more like what the human eye can see.
Is that pretty tricky though, when you're mucking around with your shutter and with the exposure? And
it's, once
it's
you get
too
used
much
to it,
light coming in or...
It can be tricky if you don't have, you know, you don't have the chops. It takes time. It's just a matter of practicing. The beauty behind the modern cameras, though, is that once you set it up and you set yourself up properly, you can replicate the process quite consistently. And that's one of the most important things about 360 photography, is to try to create lighting conditions that are relatively consistent across the board, because, you know, the human eye has an amazing amount of dynamic range in terms of how dark and how bright we can see in.
Yep.
But a camera is very, very limited in comparison to it. Even some of the best cameras are very limited in comparison. So, you know, trying in 360 photography, because it's virtual reality in a sense, it's the core of virtual reality, you're trying to create an environment that makes it as natural for a person to just feel like they're there. Mm. You know, that's the idea.
It's fascinating stuff. Mm. So what drew you into 360 photography, and did you start out in just general point-and-shoot commercial photography, and then it grew into something, or was it a hobby? Like, where did it all sprout from?
Yeah, the origin story for me is quite interesting, because, I was, from a very young age, an avid amateur photographer. In fact, the very first camera I got was a 1960-somethings camera from my brother. It was an Aries rangefinder film camera, and that I took along with me on trips and holidays when I was very young. And then I did a little bit of photography in high school, doing sports events and that kind of thing. It was just, you know, hobby again. And I kind of let that side of my life go aside, because I got much more into the world of audio. But then, you know, you get married, you have kids, you all that kind of stuff. You start taking more pictures of family and all that. And I was always the tech guy around. So, you know, anytime there was pictures to be taken, it was always me who was going to end up doing that kind of work. And how I actually got into to what I do now was, it was somewhat of an accident, in that I was working in sales for a tourism marketing company that covers basically all of Australia. But my patch was the Hunter Valley, Central Coast, Newcastle, Port Stephens, and a little bit of Sydney. It's a fairly big area. And my job was to simply sell advertising for the tourism industry on touch screens that you can go to a visitor information center and you could look at the ads, right? Kind of a cool idea. But I could see that the world was shifting, and that the idea of people going to a touch screen at a visitor information center was a bit of a passe thing when you consider that we've got these touch screens in our pockets, right? You know, and you got a tablet, you know, like the tech today, you know, it's this. So I realized that really that the world was changing that way. And the other thing that was happening is that more and more of my customers, when I wasn't closing a sale, I was asking, where are you doing your marketing? And they'd always say, on Google. Okay, all right. So it was making me realize, well, this is a pretty important thing. But at the same time, often my clients would ask for me to not just sell them the ads, but also to take a couple of extra pictures, because I was handy with it. And it dawned on me, after several of them were asking to buy the photos from me, that maybe I'm a little bit better than I thought I was. So I mentioned this to a friend of mine who is a Google AdWords specialist here on the Central Coast.
Okay.
And he says to me, well, Mark, why aren't you selling, you know, your photography work on Google? I'm going, well, what are you talking about? He says, well, there's this program you can sign up for. And if you pass and you get through it, then, you know, you may be able to, you know, offer this as a service. And I thought, okay. So I looked it up. He sent me the link. I looked it up, signed up, didn't hear back for several months. This was back in 2015. It was in January, February 2015. And I didn't hear anything back for a month or two. So I called up a few guys that were already doing this kind of work to see what it was like, and kind of dabbled a little wee bit to learn more about the industry. But I was very, I was very much into the idea of, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this myself. This is a business for me. You know? And in July.
Well, that's it, because you're starting to see the market change
and
the direction of where you want to sort of run your own race. So.
Exactly. You know, and it was a fascinating idea. And I already had a lot of great relationships with a lot of people in the area. So I thought, well, I should see whether or not this is actually going anywhere. And sure enough, in July, I get an email back from Google saying, you know, we're ready to have you submit your images. Here's the gear list. And this is what you got to go buy. Here's what you got to do. Submit your images, and we'll let you know if you pass, basically.
Really sick gear list.
So they tell you what to shoot, how to shoot it. They tell you to basically send in a sample set so that they can vet whether or not you have the skills and chops to do a good job. Mm. And I got through pretty well
That's
on the first
fair
time.
Enough.
Yeah, which is the right thing to do. Mm. And then I got the email saying, congratulations, you're now a Google certified or Google trusted photographer. And back then, when they first started, Google was the company that actually sent you the leads on who to go do the shoots for.
Really?
But then that didn't last very long, because that was Google's gone through a lot of iterations. You know, I tell people that Google is like the world's largest beta project that's ever existed in a lot of ways, especially for things like this.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So
that's funny you put it that way.
Yeah, they're constantly trying things out. Like you can think of, you know, for example, you know, Google Plus is gone now. Like there's all kinds of things that they come up with and they go, it doesn't work well enough for us. They just cancel it. Yep. But the Google virtual tour program back then was called Google Business View. That's what it was actually called back then. Mm. But then they changed it to Google Street View because Street View was a known brand. That. Yeah, because everybody knows Street View as something that they probably used when they were trying to figure out where a house was, that they were, you know, in the real estate marketplace, or if they were looking for shops or that kind of thing, or they just thought it was really,
it's
really cool.
It's so beneficial.
It really is. Mm. So what happened is that they changed the brand and they made it so that it becomes more of a self-employed, you go find your own customers, and it, which was actually a better thing in the end because it also allowed us to change our to price our services according to the quality and standards and the services that we also included along with it.
Yes.
So now in the world, there's probably 15,000 to 20,000 virtual tour photographers who are Google trusted. So it's there's a lot of people in the world that do it. The vast majority of them don't do it at a really high degree or high grade. They tend to do it with a lot of small one-shot cameras.
Okay.
But those who've been doing it for as long as I have and or longer for the most part tend to stick with quality. You know, we really care about doing a great job.
And so are there levels? Like when you're talking about Google certified, are there certain levels of 360 photographers
Not really. It's either you are or you're not. The process of being certified is actually quite simple. You simply now have to provide 50 images that are passing and, you know, don't break any other rules. Like if you don't have permissions of a person to have their face, you know, recognizable, you have to have blurred it. You make sure you blur license plates if there's cars in the shoot, that kind of thing. So there's little things, and then there's certain quality standards, and you also can't shoot a private residence and publish it on Google. That's not allowed either. So there's little rules around things that you can do and can't do. So as long as you do the right thing, you pretty well can get past. The difference comes down to is really understanding what the program is really all about, and it's to help the greater population and community to be able to have a better understanding of whether it be businesses or services or anything that might be of use to see things in 360 so that before you go there, you know what to expect. That's really what it's about.
And so would they look at it before it would get published? Like when you're talking about, because you've got to blur this out, got to blur that out, just the whole legal structure behind that?
They don't check it as much as they used to, but there still is a vetting process, and most of the vetting is essentially a public vetting process. For example, if you were to look at some of the virtual tours that I have shot, and if you saw someone's face that was not blurred, you could put in a complaint saying, I don't think that this is right. Now, what they would then do is say to the owner of the business, who I would have shot that, is this okay? And if they say, no, we've got model release forms, Mark took care of things properly, everything's cool, then there's no issue, okay? So it comes down to basically, they don't necessarily monitor everything. They do some spot checks, but they don't check it the way they used to. It's not like it used to be. So they're far more trusting of us as professionals to do a good job.
Yeah, especially like yourself, you've been doing it for X amount of years, and you know that's a lot of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. But
with the sequence of it, so is it like when you're actually performing the art of 360 photography and when you're doing these virtual tours?
Mm-hmm.
So is it a bit of like stop motion and?
Yeah.
What's the general space that you take, like meters wise? Do you always know how to?
Great question.
Yeah, like if it's within a confined area or if you're out in the open space. Like that's what I try and...
Okay, cool. No, I'm really glad you asked that because that's in fact actually one of the key elements that makes a virtual tour what it actually is. And the rule that Google has, which is a very reasonable rule, is that they want to have clear line of sight for every image between them. Because they are still images. This is not video. You know, you would not believe the amount of times, countless times I've had people ask me, can you shoot one of those 3D video things? And I have to tell them, it's not 3D and it's not video. You know, it's like, it's actually 360 degree, two-dimensional still images. Yeah, but they're 360 and they're interlinked, which makes people think that they are like
moving through it.
Exactly. So it really confuses a lot of people that way. But the distance by which I use, or the way I distance the shots, generally speaking, is as long as there is a clear line of sight between each point and that the experience between going from each point is a positive experience. In other words, if I were in like a long driveway, clear, or like a long drive, long road, and there's nothing in between except for a clear field, well, I'm not going to shoot a whole bunch of 360s all along because there's really nothing there to help you get a better understanding of what's the difference between point A to point B. That's kind of like it's redundant, right? But if I was, for example, in a business premise, in fact, actually, a good example of a business premise is, in fact, when I shot the Norahead Lighthouse's quarters, the lighthouse keeper's quarters, because that's actually a rented accommodation space. It's essentially a house. Well, you can imagine if you have to stop in front of a door to get into a bedroom, well, you can't go through the wall, so I'll stop in the hallway in front of that door and shoot a 360 in the hallway. Then I'll move into the bedroom and make sure that I can see the hallway from where the next shot is going to be taken, put the tripod down there, do the 360 there. So that when I actually connect all these little arrows, the Google Street View arrows across from point to point, you actually can see where you've come from and where you're going to very easily.
Okay.
And that's actually how that is. Generally, Google does actually have a rule. They do say ideally 4 meters apart is the maximum they want you to go.
Okay.
All right. But there's plenty of times when that rule can be broken. A good example, probably the best example I have of that is when I shot the virtual tour for Palmdale Lawn Cemetery, which is another big client of mine.
Yep.
You can imagine 26 acres, huge property. Well, there's
a lot of land.
And there's lots of it that we didn't really need. We just needed to actually interconnect the areas, right? So there was a few times when I would be shooting 50, 60 meters apart, you know, just because it was a clear line of sight.
Yeah.
It's a very reasonable option at that point in time.
So you got clear line of sight and you're saying going backwards and forwards.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just thinking also with the topography of the earth and when you're transversing.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're going up and down.
Ah, good. So, another great question. Yeah. There's two ways of dealing with levels or a multi-story building. There's times and places where if, for example, if there's the primary means by getting from point A to point B is in an elevator or an escalator, then what I would do is make sure to shoot right up to the point where that elevator or escalator starts at both ends of it. And then inside the Google Street View platform, when I publish, there's an option for actually separating the groups of images per floor and label them as L1, L2, L3, L4. And you can essentially climb through each one of those levels. That's the way that it publishes in Google Maps for levels. So that's a way of interconnecting challenging or difficult situations. But then there's also times, for example, like when I did Norahead Lighthouse, which was probably the single most complex shoot I've ever done in terms of levels, because there's no escalator, no elevator. So I'm literally shooting in spiral, going up in the staircase. So
and then just trying to get the angle
on the camera
itself.
Yeah, basically the tripod had to sit on multiple steps. One of the things that my mate Phil Manpa, who's actually the videographer, is going to be putting together. I took a bit of behind the scenes of me processing of how I actually cover up the patch where the tripod was because I was on top of the stairs. So I actually photoshopped the stairs back into place as if there was like you're floating in air kind of thing. So it's kind of a cool look and feel that way, right? So
hopefully the heritage people don't come after you.
No, actually,
Photoshop and stuff.
Yeah, but in this case, it's actually more legit than not because I actually blurred it. It would have been less authentic than the way I did it because what I'm doing is I'm actually recopying in such that it would be far more like as if you were actually
that's
there.
It. You're not cutting it out altogether.
No, exactly. Yeah. So it's actually more authentic, and that's really the intention. But that was probably the most complicated one because in that case, I can't put levels like I can with a multi-level building.
That's tricky.
So I literally have to make sure that the arrows go in a circular fashion to catch up all the way through the whole of the shoot. So, yeah.
So typically, the process of that, how long would it? Did it take just in the spiral staircase?
The spiral staircase probably took me about an hour to get done. So I shot probably about 15 to 20 photos in that section just to get all the way up. And so that's about the amount of time on. But that's actually a really small portion of where the work is. The real time is spent in post-production. Because after I've shot all that, I still have to do the initial editing to make sure I grabbed all the right images, make sure that they're looking good, that there's not things in there that don't need to be. Then I have to, and then I output those. Then I actually stitch them. Then I actually go back and do some more fixes. Then I have to set up, ready the file for publishing. Then I publish it. Then I connect all the arrows together.
That's three a lot hours, of steps.
Yeah. So what, you know, that shoot was a 3-hour shoot, roughly 3 to 4 hour shoot, but there was 4.5 days worth of post-processing in there. So that's where the work is.
You're sweating there.
Yeah.
So do you shoot in RAW or?
Yeah, I do shoot RAW. It's just far better in terms of keeping the quality. It gives me, there are plenty of people who still shoot in JPEG, but RAW does give you a lot more ability, more than anything else, for white balance, for making sure that the color of a space works well. Because you can imagine when you're shooting in a 360, you're looking out windows at times or looking out doors at times, and in that same image, you're also looking indoors. And that color space is quite different. Outside is far bluer, typically, than what you find in most of the insides. So the only way that you're going to be able to blend so that it looks, again, more like what the human eye can see, not just in dynamic range or brightness, but also in color space. And so, you know, so it's a real challenge to, so shooting and draw would really take that away. So you want to make sure that you leave yourself as much latitude to correct the imagery so that it looks natural.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, and typically on an average shoot, and you're shooting RAW, so how much data would that be chewing
up? Geez. Well, that particular tour was about, like, the total number of images I actually shot to create was probably about 2,500 images.
Yeah. Hold on, 2,500.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, right. All in RAW.
Yeah, yeah. So I have literally terabytes upon terabytes of storage that I keep for every one of my shoots. Because every time I do a shoot, I keep all the original files, all the post-processing flow files. I keep those on file too, because if ever I did need to go back and do an edit of some type, I want to speed up my work process. So, by keeping everything exactly as it was done in processing, I can just go back to where I was, that one
keeping
spot.
Keeping track.
Yeah. So you've got to be very organized. You have to have a system. You have to have a process. And by doing that, it allows me to be able to go back and do edits. And this has happened on occasion, where someone says, look at, one of my other clients here on the Central Coast is Gosford RSL. And they had done some renovations in their cafe. Well, for me to be able to go back and do an edit and just replace the cafe shots as opposed to the whole structure of the place, I needed to make sure that I had, I knew exactly where the images were, how they were numbered, where the tripod was at the time, so I could replace from exactly the same field of view as much as I could.
God, that, yeah, right.
Yeah, so that's it's a technical form of photography. It really is. Yeah.
So what gear do you need to initially get started? And like the base level.
Sure.
And say when you get into it, and say with the experience that you've had, have you designed any of your own sort of gear, if it's got to do with, not if it's anything to do with lens, camera, tripod, just to, so you're getting the, trying to get the perfect, spherical shot within what you're trying to establish there?
It's a fair question, because back in the day, before it was a more commonly commercially done service, a lot of people were actually building their own gear. But since then, most of it is already manufactured equipment that we can use. Now, it's a matter of selecting the right equipment for that. And there are times and places when even the very inexpensive 360 cameras, and I brought a few of them along that I can share, I'll show you.
Awesome.
There's with regards to small cameras, there's times and places where you can't use a DSLR. It's just physically will not fit for some types of shots. For example, you can imagine if I was shooting a 360 inside of a Spire of a cathedral, Well, you know, you probably can't get a regular DSLR kit into that space. It's just not going to fit. It's going to be too large or too heavy, especially if you have to handhold a long pole up in the air to actually take the shot. Mm. So in those types of situations, the smaller consumer level cameras are probably the only choice or a better choice. And I still have them. I'll show you here. This is...
Love camera gear.
So this over here was the very first consumer camera that I purchased. And this one over here is called a Ricoh Theta. And as you can see, it's actually got two lenses on it, right? There's one on the front, one on the back, and they're identical lenses. And this shoots a spherical image, and it does its stitching inside the camera before it outputs it. Or you can take it out and not have it that way too. So with a camera like this one over here,
can you explain to the listeners just what it looks like?
Sure. Yeah. So it basically, it looks more like a remote control. If you were to hold it in your hand, like a TV, tiny TV remote, and that has a lens on the front and back side of it. And it's got one button on it to shoot, and a couple of buttons on the side that allows you to turn it on or off, or change you can change some of the settings on the camera. Mm-hmm. And it's there's a jack on the bottom so that you can plug it in and get your images back out, because the memory card is built into this one over here because it's a sealed unit.
Okay, yep.
And it has a little 3/8 mount so that you can put it on a tripod or a pole.
Nice.
Okay, so that's essentially how you just screw that into a tripod or a pole, and then you usually would use your phone or tablet as the trigger device to trigger the camera. So that, because you would actually normally put it wherever you want it, and then you trigger it. You can actually set these up with time lapse too, so that it just keeps shooting. So you can just, you know, put it on time lapse and it just keeps going and going and going. So that's another way of shooting. This way you don't have to worry about it. But of course then, if your lighting conditions change, it doesn't work so well. So this is an example of a 360 camera that's a consumer camera, and it's, you know, these are the newest version of this camera, which is called the Z.
Too.
Yeah, the newest one's slightly larger than this, and has a much larger sensor on the inside, so it's better in terms of low light conditions, and you know, so it has better dynamic range. It's a little bit better in resolution quality, but it still won't.
And what's the brand again?
This is Ricoh.
Ricoh,
yeah. There's actually a number of camera companies that manufacture these, but it tends to be not any of the major brands. Like Canon does not do any 360 camera equipment per se. Nikon did one and got out of that business because they essentially failed miserably at it.
Yeah.
But Olympus and Pentax and all these companies that we would know if we're photographers, none of them have ever gone into it. But Ricoh is part of Pentax, but Ricoh is one of the only major brands that's actually in this space. The rest of the manufacturers that manufacture cameras that are 360 tend to be very niche. Like the next one I'll show you here.
Yep.
Which is, I'm just going to try to, it's falling on the bottom of the bag. They're so small. Here it is. So this one over here is called a Xiaomi Mi Sphere 360. And it's actually not a lot different in size. If you look at it, this is more like a square or a rectangular type camera. And this one over here is a Chinese-built camera, far actually less expensive than the Ricoh is, but actually has higher resolution. This one over here, if I remember right, is a 16 megapixel camera, and this one over here is 24. Okay, yeah, right. And it's 24, but all the way around. So you got to say it's really actually 12 plus 12, because you've got a front and back image in a 360. So this over here, and this one, by the way, doesn't work anymore. It's died. It was one that I shared usage with a mate of mine who actually took it kayaking with him. Took some great shots, but then the salt got into it, and so it's toasted. So they are really a bit, for those types of situations, they're consumer throwaways to some degree. Use them, have great fun, and next.
And do they do video as well?
Yes. Yeah, they do video. In fact, actually, this particular one, this Mi Sphere, which also is available now under the brand Madventure. So if somebody was
I've heard of that.
Yeah, the Madventure camera. It's exactly the same camera, just under two different brands. The video quality that you get out of this is pretty decent. There's also another company called Insta360.
Yes.
Which is a very popular one.
I think it was about a month and a half ago that their new release came out.
Yeah, they have they have a new one called the R model, right? But they have the 1X, which is their most popular model, and it looks an awful lot like this Ricoh Theta. You know, the remote control look kind of machine. But they also make a pro model, which is almost looks like a smallish soccer ball with a couple of cutouts on it. It's primarily designed more for doing 360 video than it is for the purpose of photos. A lot of people use it for photos because it does a decent job. I think it's an 8K camera, essentially, is what it is. But the beauty behind it is.
Hold on. 8K.
8K, yeah. Keeping in mind that you practically really need 8K in 360. And this is one of the things that's a misconception about, you know, 8K, 4K resolution. You hear 4K, you think it's a lot of resolution. Mm. Well, it's only a lot dependent on how wide your field of view is, right? If you actually need to have a view that is spherical, those pixels are going to be absolutely everywhere. They're literally all the way around you. So how many pixels do you need to be able to have a decent-looking image if it's going to be spherical? Mm. A lot more. 8K, in fact, actually isn't even... it's not particularly fantastic. It's good. Mm. It's good enough for today, and it's a more manageable file size when you're doing the post-processing. But the ideal would be between 12 to 16K in 360 to be able to have it so that it's really crisp and clear and looks like what you would normally get out of a regular DSLR camera.
It just sounds insane when you're pumping up those numbers.
Yeah, it's big files, you know, and the post-processing that goes on, you need very, very powerful computers. It's not for the lighthearted. If you don't have a, you know, it's buying these types of cameras in the small consumer level allows a person to be able to work with typical home computers and PCs and laptops and that kind of thing. But as soon as you get into this larger professional stuff, you really don't factor in just the cost of the camera. You're factoring in the cost of your post-production kit. It's no different than if you were actually a videographer. You know, you're properly set up here with multiple cameras. You've got a great kit. You know, you're going to be using a good system to do your post processing, especially if you're shooting in 4K.
Yeah,
it's the same principle when you're getting into shooting video in 360, which is not something I do. I don't provide that. I actually have mates in the industry who I'm happy to refer if someone does want that. You know, I'd rather hand over the business because these are guys that do this day in, day out, but their rigs are huge, absolutely huge.
Yeah. Mm. And what kind of rig do you use when it's when it's got to do with
for the post processing? It's a custom built PC. I didn't go down the Mac route. I could have easily gone. Most of the people who are in the photography love their Macs. We know that. That's all cool. I have nothing wrong with my wife uses a Mac. She loves her Mac.
Yeah.
But I use a PC primarily because I wanted to have the flexibility to upgrade and change the equipment a little bit more. But I'm running a 32 gig of RAM on the in the machine. It's an i7. It's about a 3 or 4 year old machine now at this point. It's still plenty powerful, and I'm running a 6 gig video card in there, and that just basically is just enough. In fact, if there's anything I'll be doing shortly, it's most likely going to be upgrading the video card, because when you're post-processing these images, you're using software that primarily uses the GPU, the graphics processing unit in your computer, and you need plenty of power of that, or else you're going to be tapping your fingers on the table an awful lot waiting for the next image to be ready.
Just trying to render and get through it all.
Yeah. So whereas like right now, I can get through the actual stitching process. Probably is about 20 seconds once it's actually all been done. It can take anywhere from about 10 minutes to about an hour to actually do the full processing of a single image. Mm-hmm. But that portion of time where, and I can tell you, my first experience in processing images, I used an old laptop, And it was like you'd go and process an image. And it's like, oh, I think I'll take the dog for a walk. it was just that slow.
That long.
Yeah, it was just really slow. So I very quickly upgraded to a much better computer.
Yeah. What software are you using to stitch all this together?
Yeah. So the life cycle of imagery, what I actually use is I use four or five different pieces of software in the life cycle. First, I just use a piece of software that's a free program for most. I pay for it because it's commercial use. Which essentially is a photo organizer. One of the ones that a lot of people like to use is UrfanView. The one I use is called FastStone. They're just basically a basic photo editing, but it's more for the purpose of just simply looking at the images very quickly just to see which ones are which ones I'm actually going to import, and which ones I won't bother to import. Mm-hmm. Once I import them in, then I put them through Lightroom, and I do through Adobe Lightroom, and I do a basic processing on the images, and I export them all as 16-bit TIFFs. So that makes that they're already getting pretty big files, because I'm starting off with 20 megapixel files, and you're dealing with a lot. So then from that point, then I go into a program called PTGUI, and that's sort of the secret sauce software. So PTGUI and PTGUI Pro, the professional version, is what allows you to take a number of images, whether they be shot with a fisheye lens, which is what I use, or other lenses for that matter, but what it does is, as long as there's enough overlap on each image, it has the capacity to look for where those points or spots on the image is exactly the same thing and stitches them together. And that's the secret sauce software. But that can get very tricky. So learning how to use PTGUI and setting it up properly, you can take courses on just learning how to do just that.
Are they good with recognition, like how to stitch?
Yes.
Like algorithms, stitching the images together. Yeah,
far better than they used to be. Nowadays, it's quite good. One of the challenges you always run into when stitching images, especially in outdoor images, is moving clouds. Because you can imagine, it doesn't know that a cloud is a moving thing, or moving cars, or moving people. Right? So anything that's moving, or even for that matter, if you're under a moving tree with the leaves moving, right? That kind of thing can really throw the stitching software an awful lot. One of the ones I always struggle with, and I try to do my best to fix back up, is moving power lines, because they blow in the wind. And you get all these, so if you look sometimes at 360 images, for the most part, I go back and fix mine. But you'll actually see where the line goes only so far, and then it's like it disappears, and it comes back. Cut lines in between. So the idea is to use a combination of PTGUI to make sure all the stitching is good. But then you have to go through Photoshop to fix that stuff, those little niggly bits that you just cannot fix in PTGUI.
Your power lines that are all over the show.
Yeah, exactly. So you're manually repainting them back in places to where they are. Yeah. And then I'm putting where the tripod used to be, because I like to cover up where the tripod was, I use another piece of software called Affinity, which is another photo editing program, very similar to Photoshop. So if anyone's actually looking for a really, really fabulous alternative to Photoshop, and it's a one-time purchase as opposed to paying on an ongoing basis, Affinity Pro is a really, really cool piece of software. And it has the ability to do spherical editing. So I can actually look around in 360 in the image and do my edits in 360. So it's a pretty cool piece of kit. Yeah. And it's not that expensive, really. It's one
That's
of those.
Good.
Yeah.
Especially if someone wants to get.
Exactly.
Like a basic startup in there, that's
for exactly.
Sure.
And then that takes care of actually producing a 360 photo.
Mm-hmm.
Then we still have to publish it, right? We still have to actually put it on online or the web so that people can actually see what it's going to look like. And you can either use programs like Pano 2VR, which is actually a publishing program. It doesn't do the stitching, doesn't do any of that stuff. It just says, give me your 360 photos, and they'll organize that into a virtual tour, so that you can publish it as a virtual tour, okay? And that's probably one of the most popular programs out there. There's a lot of other ones, KR Pano, and then there's a lot of online ones. And the one that I use by far the most for commercial applications is a product called GoThrough, which is really only available for Google Street View photographers, because they're the only ones who would actually have a need, because you actually have to be Google trusted to actually use this. And what it does is, it, again, very similar to Pano 2VR, allows you to interconnect all of the images in a virtual tour experience. So that those connections of the dots, it's like adding GPS data to the imagery and making sure that you're facing in the right direction. It's essentially what it does. So,
okay. Yeah. It's just making sure that the whole navigation path is in its right steps, going left to right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Back or forward. So.
That's right. That's right. Mm. So that's and then beyond that, there's still yet one more step beyond that, which I am particularly enamored with, is where you add additional information on top of a virtual tour, which is basically where you really, you know, gear it up into what you can actually really even call this augmented reality. Because you might remember many years ago there was a game called Pokemon Go. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah,
a lot of people go, what? Well, yeah, I remember that. Everybody was playing this crazy game looking for these Pokemons on Google Street View, right?
Yeah, I tried it in the office once when I was at work and just tried it out. And there's old Squirtle sitting on me knee there. So. Yeah.
There you go.
Got a few points. So
there you go. Right. Well done. Well done. So the thing is with that, Jake, is that when with that Pokemon Go kind of environment is, that what we want to be able to do is to take these virtual tours and augment them in a way that makes them even more usable and more useful to the end user, to the viewer. Okay, you can imagine a large property like the Gosford RSL is a good example of that, where they have multiple rooms, they have different meeting rooms, they have a pool room, they have a kiddie play area, they have a large hall, they have an entrance, they have a parking lot. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to have a menu somewhere that basically took you there first and then you could start from there? And that's what this other software does that I use. So I actually have an augmented reality layer system that I use to help enhance the virtual tour so that you can navigate to the right spot. That's step one. The next step is, what if you saw, for example, a stage in a large hall? Wouldn't it be cool if you could click on that a button on that stage that would tell you when the next event is going to be? And then it takes you into a page that's actually linked back to the client website and will give you the next show or the availability or even a call now button and a call to action button.
Good. It's like an index as such, but then with all these other functions to it.
Exactly. So those are what we call hotspots. So when you add hotspots to a virtual tour, you can really augment the experience for the end user. You can even add a YouTube video. You can just literally play a YouTube video on top of a virtual tour, or do a photo slideshow, or add the menu for a cafe or restaurant. One of my favorites is to add, when I shoot virtual tours for motels or accommodation, is to have a book now button in the room you're looking at. So when you click on that button, it just takes you right back to the booking engine and allows you to be able to say, yeah, that's the room I want. I'm happy with that. I'm actually going to book in. So that's the beauty of taking the, so you know, we started with this really cool idea of these crazy, you know, wild images, but we're really working our way all the way down, funneling down to a utility, to a service. Right? So this is something that becomes really, really powerful. And one of the things I actually do now, and this is something that I'm sure you're going to be able to relate to, and I offer this as a part of the services that I do, is, you know, highly recommend to any business that do actually have disabled access points to make sure that they have me include the virtual tour images for those areas. And if there's any additional information that they would like to have included, like, for example, the ramp is not available between these hours for whatever reason, for safety reasons, if that were the case, so that kind of information be posted. So I could put that on as a hotspot.
Yep.
So for someone like yourself, let's say you have to go to a building, go, oh, geez, well, when can I actually go? You want to be prepared. You'd be able to leverage the virtual tour as a real utility, a real tool to help you in your navigation. So those are one of the things that I highly recommend that businesses make sure that they always, you know, point out those things. You know, show me where the disabled toilets are. Show me where the, you know, disabled parking is. Because otherwise, these are all things that are absolutely critical, for anyone who's going to be in a wheelchair, who wants to be able to get around. And sometimes, it's a simple thing for them to ask for. And I'm more than happy to help them, you know, produce a virtual tour that'll help essentially be far more inclusive.
That's what it's all about, accessibility. So,
mm-hmm.
and having that, and that's interesting, and it'd be good to see. And I'm just now thinking, like, just with different disabilities and how that would, you know, it's always good with the physical, but also, you know, if it's got to do with sensory.
Yes.
Like, you know, people that are on the autism spectrum.
Yes, absolutely.
And, or, you know, having those different functions that you might be able to utilize depending on the disability that you got.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I can add in the hotspot world in these 360s is to add audio, so that if you have someone who does actually have a limited visibility, they can still see enough to navigate, they can see the button, we can then add audio content, so that basically allows them to know where they are, what they're looking, what they're actually, you know, able, if they were able to see better, that's what they would be looking at. So we can add that kind of content. So there's an awful lot of things that can be done with virtual tours. And we are talking VR, yes, we are, but it's that, this is really...
I wanted to jump into that.
Yeah, you know, and because a lot of people say, like, you know, is this VR? And I say, well, yes, it is, but it's the simplest form of VR. It's the bare bones version of VR. Because if someone was, for example, to ask for me to do a virtual tour in 3D video of the same thing I've done as a virtual tour, the cost would be, you know, 10 to 15 times higher because of the cost of production. And then on top of that, you have to say the person who's going to look at it has to have the right equipment to look at it in the first place.
Need like an Oculus Rift.
They need some kind of a head-mounted display of some type, right? Well, then that make all you're doing is you're actually making it more difficult in terms of accessibility. And not easy, not better. So finding that sweet spot in terms of how to actually present it, I actually still think that really, because Google Street View is still the world's largest virtual tour experience, the biggest 360 experience in the world, that is very, very easy for people to use because it's, you know, it's well known, it's well established, and it's easily accessible on most devices. It's still the right place to go for this stuff. You know, and that's not to say, and if Apple was to start offering virtual tours tomorrow, I'd be happy to shoot on Apple. It really doesn't bother me what mapping system people were having. It's just that Google happened to be the ones that are doing it.
And so where do you see going in the world of, say, with what you're doing, but if it is people that are using these Oculus, you know, the VR and just the world of where that's going forward with it's the VR, but also with the augmented reality folding into that as well.
Yeah. The probably the person I refer to the most often who was able to give us some guidance as to what is likely to occur is a guy by the name of Kevin Kelly. He's the guy who started a magazine called Wired Magazine, which has been around for a very long time. And he's been known as being really good at predicting technology. You know, I don't know how accurate he is, but I think he's pretty darn good at it. Better than I am. You know, he's one of these guys that you can trust. And his view was about 2 or 3 years ago, he actually said that most of the internet is going to be VR-based 5 to 7 years out. That was his prediction. Now, a lot of people, that's really quick, right? Now, you think we're in the middle of COVID-19 and everybody's using technology more than they ever have before. What we're seeing is a ramping up of the usage of technology and the adoption and acceptance of technology. So I would suspect that he's more right now than he would have even been when he first stated that. So that tells us that I think it's not that far away. To give people an idea of where I really think, if they want to try to visualize what I see the world looking like in VR, the best example is to use a movie that was put out only a few years back called Ready Player One. If you've not seen it, watch it. And you'll love it. It's really, really cool.
I've been eyeing it off, but I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, you've got to watch it, man. Okay. You're going to love it. Jake, you're going to love it. It's a great movie. It's funny because I didn't know about this movie. Of all people, the person who recommended that movie to me is Ken Duncan, who you might know.
Yes.
Ken and I are neighbors, and he was chatting with me about some of the stuff that he was interested in. And he says, have you seen this? Have you read the book? He says, because he had just read the book, and he was fascinated when he knew when he found out what it is that I do. He immediately recommended it to me. And I went, yeah, I'll get to it. And then finally one day I said, okay, I've got some time. I'm going to be doing a lot of driving. So I picked up an audio book and I listened to it and it was just fabulous. And then when I saw the movie, although the movie's never exactly like the book. I do recommend for those.
It's a ways away.
It's a ways away, isn't it? Right. But it is visually to give you a better idea of what the world might be like. You know, taking away all the drama and taking away all of the negativity that is because, of course, it's a very dark movie. but conceptually, in terms of how the tech might work.
You said it's a dark movie,
It's very dark. It's very, you know, because it's set in the year 1940, where the world basically, in the year 2040, in the future, it's kind of like a Back to the Future kind of feel to some way, where they've got, that whole feel of...
Marty Fly.
Yeah, exactly. You know, they even use the DeLorean in there.
Do they?
Yeah. Which is hilarious, because you can make anything you up in anything up in VR, right? So, but that's actually so where do I see it going? I actually do see my prediction with it is, in fact, and I've been quoted to this, is what I actually call what Kevin Kelly is saying is happening. I'd call that Web 3.0. Because right now, we're still living in the world of Web 2.0, 2.1, really. Because you think about the internet's iterations. The first one was more just basically words, characters, and pictures, and basic stuff. Web 2.0 was, we can live interact with each other. That was 2.0. 3.0 is when we get immersed. That's the next level. And and what that's going to require to change is that most of the software tools that are used for the development of websites and content online will need to adapt to web VR type standards, right? And that once that happens, so in other words, if you're a web developer right now and you're using the likes of Squarespace for small websites, or Wix or Weebly, or anything more serious, you'd probably be using the likes of some of the majors out there, the major CMSs. Once those CMSs start to switch to being totally VR based, that's when the world will.
And CMS is
a content management system, basically the tools that are mm-hmm. to build websites.
Yeah, WordPress.
WordPress is probably the biggest one around, right? Mm. Something like my website's built on WordPress. Mm.
Because you can put a lot more functions in it.
You can. But what you can't yet do is natively create 360 content inside of it. You need new tools for that.
Okay. Right?
And they are beginning to emerge, but they're. I think that there's still a lot of reticence from a lot of the web developers. They're a bit scared. It's almost like, you're taking away my toys and my tools and everything. I've got to relearn everything all over again. So there's a fair amount of that. And there's also the other question of how much is it going to cost? Mm. How long is it going to take? How many people are actually going to use it? How much more benefit is there really to it? Because there may be a lot of people who will go, a regular website's just good enough. And I agree, it might be. But we're maybe a few years away from that, but it's coming. It's coming. Mm. And that's going to change the world. That's the thing that's going to make it so that, there's another thing that actually has to change too.
Scare me, Mark.
You know what?
Scare
there's one more thing that has to change.
Yeah.
Jake, we have to stop wearing glasses that look like big machines on our head. The head-mounted displays like the Oculus Rift or the those types of headsets.
Okay.
We got to get it down to the size of a regular pair of glasses. And once we actually get VR that's this big... or smaller even yet, where, for example, it's like a contact lens you wear, then we're done. Then we're really there.
Jeez.
And that's coming.
That's scary.
Mm.
When you're talking about contact lens, bringing it down to, when you're comparing it to the Oculus Rift.
Yeah.
Are there any companies out there at the moment that are... got any prototypes going?
I've seen some photos of prototypes. How real or how developed those things actually are, I really don't know. Mm. But I do know that there is an awful lot of equipment that's actually in the size of regular glasses. In fact, Google Glass was an early iteration of that concept, but more from the purpose of looking out as opposed to seeing in. So it's sort of the wrong way around. It's more the augmented reality space.
It didn't last that long.
It didn't. No. There was a number of photographers who got involved with it. One of them being Trey Radcliffe was a big proponent for it. He's an American photographer who's very well known for his HDR photography. And he was involved in that project, but that actually died off. And I think there was a fair amount there was a lot of actually businesses that didn't want you wearing them when you'd walk in because they were scared you're, scoping the place out and that kind of thing. So
because I think they were saying that I'm not 100% sure, but on the Google Glass one, mm-hmm. like when something's recording, mm-hmm. that when you got the red light flashing,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it had that on the Google Glass initially. And that's what they're worried about.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's going to be getting spied on.
Exactly.
You're not going to know when anybody can record it.
It's a funny thing to think about. But that's, you know, we're not that far away from that technology. You think about how much more willing we are at giving up our privacy today. You know, and you think about 15, 20 years ago, to say that we actually have as much information about ourselves on Facebook and on Instagram and LinkedIn and that kind of thing, we would have never thought of sharing that much about ourselves. Well, now it's just what we do every day is just standard, you know, business practice and personal practice to some degree. And that is sort of the it's kind of like the frog in the water, you know, the boiling water syndrome, where you put the frog in cold water and bring up the heat up very slowly, and eventually they don't know they're getting boiled. Well, that's essentially what's happening with our privacy over time. So, you know, the way I tell people is, if you think about it in the world of business, you don't really want to be all that private. You want people to know what you're doing. But in your personal life, you probably do want to be private. And it's about understanding where to draw that line.
Yeah, trying to have the balance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, destinations.
Mm. Yes.
Where is this type of work taking you?
Yeah.
And also, what's been your most memorable place?
Sure.
Or, you know, actual shoot or whatever it may be.
There's been a heck of a lot. And in terms of, you know, I can sort of start going backwards. The destination where I see it is basically that, because my business is not just doing the virtual tour photography, to me, it's an element. It's one of the services I provide, because I also help businesses in making sure they actually get found on Google Maps, and I help them optimize their listings and that kind of thing. You know, make sure they're on the other directory listings. I see that basically the future for me is that I'll continue to do virtual tours. There's still going to be the sort of the core, call it the sexy product, if you want, that I provide, because people love to look at great images.
Yeah.
But it's going to become far more commonplace and accepted over time. And it'll be just one of those things that just gets included as part of a standard package for marketing for a business. I also do online reputation and showcasing of reviews and requesting reviews to help businesses build up their online reputation. So all of that, those elements are just as important to make sure that they work in conjunction with each other. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the world of photography, because of the fact that we're all dealing with cameras in our phones that are so incredibly good, it's making standard photography far more accessible to just about anyone. The fact of the matter is that a lot of the world of photography is actually becoming far more consumer-based. You know, we look at these small little handheld consumer cameras that I've pulled out to show off. They're going to get better. They're going to get smaller and more powerful, and eventually one day they'll outperform the equipment I'm currently using to shoot my 360 tours with right now. So, you know, once we get to that point, and it's something that anyone can do, you know, without even thinking, with virtually very little skill, how much room will there be for me to actually shoot commercially unless I do something different?
Okay.
Right? So I say basically, for me, it's more about making sure that I continue being I don't want to call it bleeding edge, because it's not. But in that space, because it's an important space, but to make sure that I branch out in other areas, to make sure that my business model stays viable.
So is it a bit of, you know, scared but excited at the same
time? It is. Of course it is. You know what? Yeah. It's a scary space, you know. And one of the things, as you can tell, I'm very open with what it is that I do. I don't hold anything back. I'm not a person who says that, you know,
and
anything.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it's very much, you know, I can see where, if you're not going to be the one who's open, chances are you're probably, it's because you're actually not staying on top of your technology. You know, that's a fearful mindset, and I prefer to have a mindset that's far more growth based and, you know, prepared for the future. And the only way to do that is to, you know, press on and stay on top of the new tech, but at the same time accepting the fact that, you know, the best thing you can do is to share what you know with others, because all that will do is move you forward. You know, it pushes you along. So that's what, you know, really what I'm doing. So what I'm most excited about, it really is really where the future is in terms of this technology and how they'll all blend together. Mm. Where VR, AR, XR, all of these technologies are going to come together.
Hold on.
You know?
VR.
AR and XR. XR meaning mixed. XR means mixed reality. It's when you take the two and mix them together. All right? And that's basically where things are all coming together, right? So we're going to see more and more of that over time. It's going to take a while.
So where can you see that at the moment with XR?
XR, well, in fact, actually, to some degree, the idea of using the hotspots on the virtual tours is essentially kind of using VR and AR at the same time, because I'm actually shooting virtual tours, which are classified as virtual reality in terms of their source, and I'm adding something on top of it. So that's an augmentation to that piece of content. So that's essentially mixing the two. So that's essentially what XR means, is simply where you're doing the two. Now, you could even go further with that, is where you begin to interact with it, which is, imagine where you're a doctor and you're wearing a headset and you're doing a virtual reality operation on someone who's on the other side of the world. So you're actually operating remote tools in, you know, that actually are like robotics, where you're actually mixing in robotics. That's actually going to be part of that too.
That's next level.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you can see things. I've heard of things to do even, you know, with sights. Mm-hmm. Not just with sights, sorry, because that's what you're generally doing with AR and VR, but smells and some of these other sensory things that
come into
play.
That's right. When you deal with haptics, is the term that's used for touch in the world of virtual reality. So when you actually have haptic equipment development, which is starting now, where you actually, there do exist some prototype, and actually, I don't know how functional they are, but haptic gloves, where you can put on a glove, and as you move the fingers in the hand, you can actually grasp something. So now what they're actually doing, and this would be, again, in the space for the disabled space, is actually providing that capability where you can start to actually, from a mind message, training the mind to be able to actually have grasping capability. So, you know, there's some really cool stuff coming, man.
It's just making think of buddy James Cameron and Avatar and all that sort of stuff.
That's So the future is looking bright in that sense. It's probably not coming anywhere fast enough for some, and probably way too fast for other people who are fearful. But it's to find that nice blend, you know, of moving it forward but keeping it on the right side of good for people. You know,
hopefully he stays there.
Yeah.
On the good side. But where was it gonna go? Okay, just so with your work, with your business, and with businesses that are out there currently and other organizations, so how do they best benefit with your expertise?
Sure. The thing I would tend to recommend is that if a business is premises based, they're a physical location of any kind whatsoever, chances are, unless you really actually have, like, unless you're a research facility that has to keep all of its secrets secret, then you probably have benefits or reasons to show off your premises, whether it be for easy access, or for marketing, or simply just to help people navigate their way, whether it be a library for a council or a skate park for the councils. Those are things that would be, you know, would benefit from what I provide, right through to cafes and restaurants. Typically the areas that I tend to really believe that are my top end clients, if you wish, is more the function centers and event centers. Like one of the ones I shot last year, at the end of the last year, was the Crown Plaza in Terrigal, all of their event centers on the main floor. Nice. So for a venue like that, where they need to be able to do what they often call, the term they use in the industry is called doing a famil, which means a familiarization experience, where they have future potential guests come and see the place and walk around and get a sense of what's on offer so that they can bring their convention or exhibition or that kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense, because you have a lot of event managers and planners like that.
Exactly.
That would want to get a feel.
Exactly.
If they're going to travel, say, from Perth to over this side of the country, so then they can get a feel for the physical structure, and then they can actually get out here and go, oh, okay, this is
exactly
what we saw beforehand.
Exactly. So it's that first initial step for vetting whether or not the property is in fact the right choice for their event. You know, I have to say that one of the things I find quite fascinating, because one of the areas I've not touched on much, and I'll bring it up because it is important to bring up, to not exclude it, is that virtual tours have been used in the real estate industry for some time already for selling houses. And it was one of those things that
we're seeing it
a lot more now. You've probably seen it quite a bit more. And there's a number of companies out there that provide, 360 cameras. And in fact, actually it's to the point now where a lot of real estate agents are actually even buying their own cameras and doing it themselves and just not even bothering with, the kits that I use. They may sacrifice a little wee bit in quality, but they're often, okay with that because they're just really looking at it as a commodity or a tool to sell the property and move on. And in those types of properties, it makes sense to basically shoot probably mid to lower grade, simply just because once it's gone, it's gone. It doesn't really have to be really high end unless it's a big, $3 or $4 million property on the water and you really want to show it off. Then it makes sense to get someone like myself in to shoot those types of properties for them. But for the most part, the real estate industry is one of those that actually has been adopting this space a lot. But I don't work in that space that much. I do a little bit when if I get requested during, I did a few houses here and there, but not that much. So really for me, the vast majority of my work is commercial spaces. So, car dealerships. I've even done the inside of cars, which is kind of a cool thing.
I saw that.
You saw that? Did you like that one?
I don't know if it was a yellow AMG or whatever.
It was a Mini.
Oh, I thought it was, I wasn't too sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not, because I was going through the steps.
Yeah.
And then I saw that it went to the car and I'm like, no, he's not. And
Bang,
he jumped in the bloody driver's seat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was the shoot that I did for Worthington Minis here on the Central Coast. I've done a lot of work for Brad and his team, the great, great bunch of guys there. Mm-hmm. But I've done the interiors of cars, and those are very challenging because those are tight spaces. And those are, sometimes I actually wish I would have actually shot it with these simple cameras. But the concern I had in that situation is I wanted to maintain a really high resolution. So I continued to shoot with a DSLR. So it just means that, when I do the inside of a car, as opposed to being, 20 minutes, I'm done on an image, I could be an hour and a half, 2 hours, 3 hours, and I'm still fiddling trying to get it to stitch properly. Yeah, so it can be really complex because things that get closer are actually harder to stitch than things that are further away. And in a car, everything's really close.
Yeah, especially in a Mini.
Yeah, exactly. But it's great. Yeah, so those are the kinds of businesses and services that can benefit. So as I said, is anywhere at all that's a premises-based organization or a place should really seriously be thinking about including this as content. If I publish it on Google Maps for you, that means that every time someone clicks on it, it's more clicks that Google are picking up on that basically say, hey, this is an important place. So it sure is not gonna hurt your SEO. If anything, it'll help, right? So why not for that purpose? And then if we take that content and augment it and put all that extra information on top of it and then place that inside your website, imagine the power and the value and the points of differentiation you're giving your business at the time too, so that's a really big advantage.
And does it work out like advantage wise, like when you're talking about SEO, if you're bringing in analytics where it's to show, okay, well, I've had this, my work has been up on this website or wherever it's within your own and where the analytics can, they show the graph lines and X, Y, and Z and, hey, this is my work, this is what I provide. Is it sort of along the lines of that?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, Google did some studies on the power of 360 content and in photography in general, but focusing on 360. And they had their tests or studies were showing a 42% increase in engagement because of virtual tours. So
that's huge.
It's part of what, if you actually, because you're following me on LinkedIn now, you'll see every once in a while I'll put up a post and I'll add a hashtag in there called herd of elephants. And people go, what the heck is herd of elephants? What's he talking about? Like, what's this?
Not in Botswana.
What it is that, we've also heard the term, there's an elephant in the room, and we know what that means. It means that there's something really big that we're not paying attention to, that we're ignoring. Well, I tell people that Google My Business, which is where my virtual tours are published, isn't the elephant in the room. It's a herd of elephants. So that's why I call it herd of elephants. So if you see the hashtag herd of elephants, it's probably me basically telling you, this is one of those things that's so big you should really be paying attention to it, because it's truly that important. And it's often way, way overlooked. Yeah, because it's too easy. It's too
40-odd%. That's huge.
It's massive. It's massive. Yeah. So
bang. Yeah. We're back. We're back.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
So yeah, we were talking, so with regards to the world of, you know, helping businesses get found, the power of 360 photography is that it's, you know, we got to remember too that the reason why Google says, you know, 42%, you know, is what they're seeing as the increase in results for search in photography is that with virtual tours, they're not regular images. They're 360 degrees. They see everything. And we know how Google is smart, right? Mm. Google is very, very smart. They have the ability to do things like face detection, right? Well, imagine this. I want you to take it one step further when it comes to a 360 virtual tour of, let's say, a retail store. Let's say it's a home catering equipment, cookingware, you know, kitchenware kind of shop. It's going to see spoons in the virtual tour. It's going to see cooking utensils. It'll see pans and pots. And it's going to say, ah, I know what that stuff is, right? Google is smart enough with its virtual, with its artificial intelligence to look at a plate of pasta and tell you if it's linguine. Okay, it's that good. So you've got to think about, why is it that they want me to shoot these virtual tours?
That's
really
scary.
It's that I'm actually, you know, and this is where that relationship and privacy versus business value of business purpose comes in, is the more that we show off what a business has on offer, the more that Google can actually serve up the right business for that particular search, right? Because how, you know, and how does it do that? Well, it uses obviously keywords, but it also looks at key content in images. And that content is derived from what images? Well, it can be photos of a business, but here's the thing with regular still images. They're far easier to Photoshop. They're far easier to shoot of something somewhere else. Far easier to use stock images. Far easier to use all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the business. And that can actually then confuse or hurt the search experience for the end user. Whereas a virtual tour, when it's shot at a business, is nothing else but that business. It was shot by a Google Trust photographer, someone they already have a relationship with. They know I'm there to do that. I publish it directly to their Google My Business page. There's no way it's going to be about anything else. And they also know that people like me, who care about doing good quality work and representing the business as well, will make sure that the only kind of Photoshopping that's going on is the stuff that's appropriate, necessary, but not deceiving, but actually helpful. Mm. All right? So in other words, if someone is in there in the store shopping with their child, immediately I, you know, blur the child out. So that, you know, for privacy reasons. But like, for example, if I'm in a pool supply shop, I'm going to make sure that you can see that, you know, they've got all the chemicals, they've got the salt bags, you can see all that stuff. You know, it's going to be very, very visible. Mm. And they'll be able to pick up on that. So again, from an SEO perspective, you're actually really feeding the single most important search engine, the one that's got 94% of the search on the planet.
Yeah, and SEO, I know what it means, but if you just want to...
Sure, yeah, search engine optimization is what it stands for. But here's the thing, too, that's really important about that term and how it works in with what we do in the world of photography and virtual tours, is it works in the space of what's called local SEO. And there's a slight difference between SEO and local SEO, because search engine optimization simply means helping Google, Bing, you know, and Yahoo, whatever's left of Yahoo, basically present or show off the closest, best quality, best, most relevant search they can. Okay. Now, local SEO basically says, well, it's got to be location based. It's geographical in nature. And that's the real distinct difference, because in the world of
especially
SEO,
especially when you want to hone in on a certain aspect of your business and where it's going to benefit.
Exactly. Whereas, you know, if you know, here's an example where local SEO doesn't work is an online business that sells strictly online. You never see a customer coming through the door. They ship from a warehouse and all they want to do is show off their product. Well, then local SEO probably isn't really the right angle for them in terms of marketing. Mm. So a virtual tour for them probably wouldn't be all that useful per se, unless they were trying to show off you know, that they do actually have a big warehouse, which is all fine and dandy. But really, it's more designed to help from a geographical perspective. And one of the things that I actually teach my clients when it comes to marketing, because it's part of, you know, all this comes down to marketing in the end in one way, shape, or another, is something I call the GDP of marketing. And GDP of marketing, most people hear the words or the initials GDP and they think of gross domestic produce, right? Well, not marketing. It's not marketing. Marketing is geographic, demographic, and psychographic. Those are the three things that define whether or not a local person is going to be finding what they're looking for. Are they close enough? Are they the right kind of person? Are they going to be, like, for example, if you're into kayaking, the psychographics is I'm into sports, I'm into kayaking, right? So you're going to want to find a place like Kayak Central Coast to be able to go buy your kayak at. So you're looking at the GDP of marketing is really what you want to be able to show off. And that's why it's so important to make sure that you show off what the business has on offer. So that's really where the core of SEO really in a local domain lives, whereas SEO for otherwise would be something that you would probably tend to think more about the optimization of the website's content, like making sure that you have an about page and it's properly linked and that there's, you know, other companies referring back to you and you refer to them. That's all good SEO techniques, which are all important. But that's not local SEO. And the space I work in is really the local part.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So going back to not necessarily the gear that you use in the actual cameras and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It sort of is, but travel aids. I'm thinking when you're with photography, if there's ever been any need of, like, I'm just thinking along the lines of like a Segway or anything like that. Or also with drones.
Yes. Okay.
When it's got to do drones take flight with 360 photography.
Sure. Yeah.
Is there much?
Is there demand?
At all?
Yeah, there is. In fact, actually, and it's far more expensive to do. It's far more work. And I do typically with that because I'm not a certified drone operator, but I work with certified drone operators. And when it's an appropriate choice, it's an excellent way of giving, again, from a geographical perspective, a greater, it's not 30,000 foot view, it's more like about a 400 foot view, because that's about how high up a drone could fly. But then with that, those are definitely things that I have used on many occasions. In fact, with Palmdale Lawn Cemetery, we used a drone for that. I've done one, and this was with a mate of mine here on the Central Coast, who's excellent at what he does. We did a drone shot in at Brisbane Waters, but I also work with other photographers who are specialists in my field, where I do their post-production for them, where they send me the images, and what I do is I'll have them send the drone images and I actually do the stitching of the images for them, because they're far more complex, because you're talking about 30 some odd images, 40 images in a drone 360 for one single one. Because, you're dealing with a drone camera that can only see only so much at a time as it rotates all the way around.
Yeah,
so
you gotta, true.
So, yeah, and those images are huge. They're massive to work with. Mm. But and they look great. You know, it's amazing what you can see from a drone 360. So,
interesting.
Yeah, so, and they're great when you've got, for example, one of my clients who's also she's not only a client, she's also a good friend and colleague who does virtual tours as I do in Sydney. She has clients in Sydney who have multiple faculties or locations for their business. Mm. So what we'll do is we'll actually have a drone shot high enough up where we can actually have one of those hotspots that'll link you to the other virtual tour of the other premises.
Really?
Yeah, so we can counterlink in a custom layer, this augmented reality layer, we can actually add hotspots to link virtual tours to virtual tours together. So that you can see
that's
multiple
really
properties.
Good.
Yeah, very, very useful.
Especially when you're talking about SEO and if you're going to have, you know, partnerships with the other organizations.
That's it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so
that's great.
You know, if you think about it, like, let's say that you're a retailer and you have, five different shops in a greater area. Like, let's say that you had one in Coogee, one in Bondi, one in, Darlinghurst or something like that, where you could, you know, fly a drone that's, you know, in a legal, legit place where it's, you know, you're able to do so, get up high enough, and just make sure that you actually have that one drone shot linking all the three shops together. So it's just one more way of actually leveraging that technology. So
technology.
Yeah.
Have you ever got the snorkels on? Got underwater?
I haven't. I don't swim. You're gonna laugh about that one. I've never actually done any work with someone who does, but I know someone who has done it. In fact, actually, a guy by the name of Aaron Spence, shout out to him, he's a great guy, and he runs a company in Brisbane which has done some of the work for Google in what's called Sea View, where you actually have essentially Google Street View but underwater, and there was 360 camera work done underwater where they were doing capture. And so absolutely, yes, that's an area. The challenge with underwater is, as we know, water tends to warp what we see, which is one of the challenges.
Yes.
It also takes out many of the colors. We can't see as many colors underwater. So there's actually a change of the what because like the reds basically kind of just disappear.
Is that a nightmare when you're trying to... In post?
It would be, yes. It would be because especially, it depends. It depends on what it is you're photographing. If those things are, if you can find things underwater that are still, and like that you can actually say, all right, like that, let's say that it's a shipwreck. If it's a shipwreck, it's not going to move much. It's, if it's fallen to the bottom, it's probably going to stay there, right? Mm. If you're in a coral reef, and it's an old coral reef, it's probably not going to move much. So you'll actually be able to stitch those images together reasonably well. That's actually one of those times when using one of these types of all-in-one cameras, these 360 cameras that have them, all the lenses built into them all-in-one, would work better because the likelihood of things moving about in the imaging is very small because you can actually, with these types of cameras, shoot all of your images in one shot, right? They shoot multiple directions at the same time. So the likelihood of being able to stitch that final image is far higher. It's one of the big differences. Whereas when I shoot with this particular rig over here, this 300, this one over here, this is my standard camera, and it's just a DSLR with a fisheye lens.
Yeah. So take us through all this gear that you got here, and if you can explain it for the listeners.
Yeah. So what I've actually got here is I've got a Canon 70D is what I'm shooting with. I also shoot with a Canon 6D. Could I shoot with far better, newer gear? Yeah, absolutely, yes. But, you know, would you actually be able to tell the difference? Probably not. But I use the lens I've got mounted at this moment in time is a Sigma 8mm fisheye. And the way that I actually shoot these images is by mounting the camera to a tripod, but mounting it directly to the lens. So this is actually, the tripod mount goes directly to the actual lens at the center of what's called the no parallax point of the lens. And the no parallax point is that I'll pretend that this is actually on a tripod right now. If I rotate the camera, you'll notice that it's moving on a single axis, right? Okay. The axis point in the middle over here means that as I move around, what it sees doesn't move because the parallax, if you ever want to understand how parallax works, it's quite simple. You can try this, everyone at home. Simply just cover up one eye and look at something and then move your hand to the other eye and you'll see that whatever you were looking at looked like it moved. Right?
That's true.
Okay. And the reason why it did that is because your eyes are, about 2-3 inches apart from each other, roughly. And, that 5-centimeter, distance apart, what that does is that's what allows you to see things in 3D or to triangulate the position of an image, of a thing. Whereas a camera, this type of a camera, it's like a one-eyed Jack, right? It can only see one in 2D. So if you actually were to move the camera in the same way that we move our head, what's behind what you look at would actually be moving, so you'd end up with what's called a parallax error. Try stitching an image, it's got parallax error in it. Practically impossible. It's very, very hard. So the solution to that is to shoot in a way that makes sure that the lens sees exactly the same thing as it rotates around on its center axis. That makes sure that each one of the images, when you stitch them together, will actually have no parallax. Now, a lot of people refer to it also as the nodal point, and that's actually incorrect. It's actually called the no parallax point.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's an impressive unit you got there.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. You know, it's a simple enough rig. You know, it's reasonably affordable. I mean, you know, you can really get into doing 360 camera work of this quality. You know, a lens like this is about $1,000, just under $1,000. A DSLR for, you know, $1,500. The mount is one of the things that a lot of people find quite complex to, and inexpensive to buy. These mounts come in all types and sizes. This one is a very small one. But I also use this is a far larger mount. This is one for putting
extremely... God, that's a rig.
That's, this one over here. Again, this is to do no parallax work. And simply what I do is I put this on the tripod. And then I screw this into here. Is it going in? There we go.
There you go. Start
okay. All right. So now what we've got now is, and this is called a Nodal Ninja. That's the name of this brand. Okay. And then by putting...
What is the sound of that?
Okay. So what this does is it gives us the ability to turn, as opposed to only four times like I do with this camera, because I take four shots with this camera all the way around. If I used a longer focal length, like a 15 mil or a 24 mil or a 50 mil lens, then I would need to take more shots just to complete the whole sphere, right? So then you need to have the ability to rotate and stop at the right points. So you can actually stop multiple times, and it's basically a way to ensure that you get the number of degrees on each stop.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice and simple, and then so you basically shoot all the way around, and then once you've finished looking straight across, you can then loosen this up and then shoot upwards, shoot downwards, and then you've got all of your images all the way around. So you know, like for example, if I shoot with this lens over here, which is what this is set up for, this is a 15 mil lens. As opposed to shooting four around, I shoot six around and one up. So six images, so I'm stopping it more often.
Ah, I see.
Okay, and that means that I'll end up with a larger, higher resolution image. If I want even higher resolution yet, I can go from this to my 16-35 f4, or I can go to I can even put on my 70-200 if I wanted to. Be a little bit big, but you know, it's doable. People do it, you know, and yeah, shoot really high resolution images, but then you're shooting, you know, sometimes as much as literally hundreds of images all the way around. So that makes for what they call gigapans, which is a gigapixel panoramic image. So you can have really, really super large images. I've shot a few of them for fun. I never actually had anybody commission me to do work for that because of the cost and time, but definitely it's something that can be done. And it's all done with this kind of very, very cool gear.
So where can you get this gear from?
Most of this kind of gear is online. You're not going to find too many stores that sell this kind of stuff.
No.
Right? I mean, if we were in...
I've never gone into a camera store and seen any of these.
Yeah, this particular kit over here I bought online from a guy in Germany. This one I bought secondhand from a guy who gave it a go and decided that 360 photography was too hard. So I got it. But this is actually Nodal Ninja is an American based company. But I believe that they have, their primary offices have now moved to Hong Kong. This is also another Nodal Ninja, but there's a number of brands that do offer this kind of stuff. But generally speaking, it's going to be an online purchase. You pretty well need to know what you're looking for, you know?
Yeah. And that's the way that we go with a lot of purchasing these days, especially when, you know, COVID and can't really get out and about.
Exactly. So. You know, I would love to buy this kind of stuff locally. I'm a big fan of Shop Local. I know I'm part of Bigger Backyard program. I've been joined up with that with my mates over at the Digital Tribe. So something that we do believe in, but there are some things you simply just can't buy locally. There's just not common enough of a need.
Inspiration.
Yes.
Where does it come from?
That's a really great question too, because you know what? The vast majority for me comes back to the principles by which I've essentially lived my whole life. I've done all kinds of work in my days. And I'm one of these dog's breakfast kind of guys, because I ran a mobile DJ company for 27 years. I spent 10 years at Radio Shack managing Radio Shack stores. I was a life insurance agent for a while. I've done training in the insurance industry. I've sold advertising and marketing, I mentioned before. So I've done all kinds of things. But to me, there's always been an element of bridging the gap between technology and people. That's really what it's about. And my inspiration really comes from being able to have that, that's how that works moment with people, and having them be able to leverage better tools to get better results. That whole moment that they have when they have an aha moment, that's what I feed off of. I really enjoy being able to help others achieve their goals.
Mm. That's great. And what was I going to say? That just escaped me, thought.
It's all right.
But so inspiration.
Mm.
But it seems also when you're talking about bridging people together.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, apart from getting out and doing your work with businesses and organizations,
yes,
do you also teach people or bring on students or along the lines of that?
Yeah, the vast majority, I actually have done some tutoring and training for photographers. I have done some of that. There's a fellow, actually, he's a very talented photographer. He does this as a part-time thing, but his day job is actually as a police officer in Atlanta, Georgia. And he and I connected up. He was really curious about my work, like what I was doing. And I've coached him through. This wonderful young lady who I said I partner up with in Sydney. She's amazing at her in sales, and she needed to learn how to use this technology. So I helped her get up to speed with that. And we continue to work together on a regular basis for other projects. So I do partner up with people that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
If you wanted to run, like if it was paid webinars or whatever it may be.
So. Yeah, I've done some webinars too. In fact, actually, there's a group of photographers who I connect with very closely with called, it's a podcast out of the United States called This Week in Photo. So if anybody's really into photography and wants to follow, if you're just an incredible enthusiast and you're just really into photography, check out This Week in Photo with Frederick Van Johnson. He's become a good friend.
Shout out.
Yeah, good shout out to him, man. He's a great guy. Anyway, he's interviewed me a few times, but he also has interviewed me on a few occasions in terms of how I do exactly what I do here, but also on things on such as marketing. Like one of the areas that I do a lot of training and support with, because I have so many years in business, is things like helping people with their LinkedIn profiles. So we did a whole webinar on how to improve your LinkedIn profile if you're a photographer. So we did a whole, it was a proper training session on all of the bits and pieces, even with information sheets to go along with it that they can download, PDFs, all that kind of thing. Because I actually did do a lot of training for a long time. So when I was in the insurance industry, so I did that for 10 years. So the idea of education is really important to me too. So I've definitely done some of that.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. There's the world of technology like this really is moving so fast that if you're not a good learner, you're probably going to fall behind. And the best way I've found to be a good learner is to be a good teacher. Because if you can help others, mentor them through the process, chances are that you're not going to want to give them bad information, so you'll learn it even better yet yourself.
That's true,
Yeah.
So you got to get in and have a crack, and that's how you evolve and get better and, share the love with a lot of the people that are out there. So.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Mark, so if you'd be able to shout-outs, or if people want to get a hold of you.
Sure.
Social media, LinkedIn, website, whatever it may be, mate, throw it out in the atmosphere if that's all right.
Absolutely. The best places in terms of a couple of shout-outs that are really worthy of paying attention to, especially for us here on the Central Coast, is one of the organizations that I'm the co-host of, along with Isaac Feeney and Brendan Rogers, is LinkedIn Local Central Coast. So we actually we started the organization back in October of 2018 and have held many events live in person before COVID. And we snuck one in last month. month, but while things look like we're looking very safe, but we're back online again. So if somebody wants to join us online this Monday night, we're going to be hosting another LinkedIn Local event. All you have to do is look up LinkedIn Local Central Coast. There's a website for it. You can link on Zoom. Come and join us. We are going to be talking about basically things LinkedIn and things business and marketing and self, and essentially how do you promote yourself online. So that's one of the organizations, and it's one of the best places to find me because I'm always on LinkedIn. I spend more time on LinkedIn than I do on Facebook, and I'm barely on Instagram at all. So that's really the best place to find me in terms of social. And as far as other organizations that I work with is I'm also on the board of directors for Central Coast Tourism. So, you know, people who are in the tourism industry who are looking for ideas on, you know, what kind of content should they be creating? What should they be doing in terms of the tourism industry? Always happy to help them with those ideas, have that conversation, maybe introduce them with other professionals who are digital specialists. Because one of the other organizations I belong to is called the Digital Tribe here on the Central Coast, which is a group of us who are specialists in multiple fields in business, mm-hmm. but with a digital bent on it. And we're there to help businesses make sure that not only do they end up making the right decisions in terms of marketing their business or improving their business online, but also that they go about it in the most productive and organized fashion. Because often people will go, well, should I do SEO first, or should I spend money on AdWords, or should I spend money on Facebook? And they don't know what to do, or they don't know if they should buy a CRM. They don't know if should they do some training at the office? So what we actually have is a team of people who work together to make sure that we can do a good gap analysis on the business and find out really what's really the best way to go from there, so that we can provide them with the best toolkit or next step to advance their business online. So those are some of the organizations they belong to. Otherwise, as far as finding me, the easiest place to connect with me on social, as I said, is on my LinkedIn profile. If you just look me up, Mark Charette, you'll find me very easily. Otherwise, my website, which is workpics.com, workpics.com.
Awesome.
Great.
Mark, much appreciated, brother.
Jake, it was a real pleasure. Really enjoyed spending some time with you today.
Yeah. And, mate, well, I look forward to jumping into more of this tech stuff with you.
Yeah, cool.
And let's give a crack with some of these.
Yeah, let's do a 360 shoot. And what we'll do is we'll set it up right here on the center of the table, and then we'll get the whole layout, so people will get a sense of this is how you run the biz.
Awesome.
All right, cool stuff. Right,
thanks, let's mate. Do it. Appreciate it.
Alrighty.
Cheers.
Technical wizard of the 360 photography world, Mr. Mark Charette. Was awesome just seeing his thorough explanations of the gear that's used and just how that all works. Programs involved, all of it was great. Good insight for me, obviously, because I love using tech equipment like cameras and the like, so it's good stuff. And if you liked it, hit that subscribe button, be much appreciated. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permaville Australia, greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. Serato, see you on the next one.